Okay, so this is lecture two of the computational biology class for fall 2002. Any questions about logistics or biology or anything like that before we start? This is going to, I think, be our new room. So come in here. It's on, I guess the official room number is, I guess, Union 135 or something like that. So you don't have to go downstairs and upstairs. Any questions about the room? Do people like this room better than the other room? Is there anybody who likes the other room better? Okay, so then we'll stay in here until they kick us out. What else is new? I'm commencing with the taping, and we've made some technological breakthroughs as far as taping the class. In principle, I'll be getting one of these digital tape recorders we discussed last class, and so hopefully in a couple classes we'll be using that for audio. But any questions? Okay, so what I'd like to start off with is, last we started talking about sort of biology for computer scientists. I'd like to finish up with a couple of, a brief discussion of certain biotechnologies that every computer scientist, everyone in the class should be aware of. Because sort of the building blocks of a lot of the experiments that the biologists do or that come up in genomics. So, the thing that I personally find as a computer scientist amazing for about biology or any of these real lab sciences is actually working with something. You know, you're actually measuring molecules, and molecules are very small things, and you're trying to measure properties of them. This is something that's kind of amazing. I mean, as a computer scientist, I live in a world where everything is digital and everything is fixed. They know how to manipulate it. These people live in a world where they're manipulating molecules. And there are a couple of standard technologies for doing this that everyone should be aware of. And to me, they're every bit as amazing as sort of how you make VLSI chips. I mean, VLSI chips are an amazing thing. You know, you somehow are able to etch these transistors at micron-level thickness, and somehow it all works, okay? And there's sort of equivalent technologies, in some sense, that for measuring DNA that we need to know about. So what can biologists do? What are the elementary operations a biologist can perform? One of them that you should know about is something called DNA synthesis. There are just DNA synthesis machines that you can type in, you know, basically a short sequence of A, C, G, and T. Let's say 25 bases, maybe up to 75 bases routinely. And out will come a test tube of DNA molecules built with that particular sequence. So it's something, there are these synthesis machines, and an elementary operation a biologist could perform in principle is type in a short sequence and get back a test tube of molecules with those sequences. Okay? Actually, these days, more often than you use the machine, they will call, this actually will send, write a check and send it to some outsourcing service. And the next day by FedEx will come a test tube of molecules with their specific pattern. So that's one thing that they can do. And the way these machines work is basically they grow the molecule one base at a time. You know, there's a machine that will say, okay, here's an empty molecule. What do you want me to stick on next? And it'll then grow it, everything by an A, if you wish. And then after all the molecules are grown by A, then they'll say, grow at the end of it, grow a C, grow a G. Okay? And so in principle, that's an operation they can perform. Okay? Synthesis. Another, any questions about that? Yeah. Right, so basically they can grow relatively short molecules to specification. Typically up to 75, roughly 75, which is a technology dependent thing. Why is it 75? Again, I tell you that you've got a process where you've got to start out with a bunch of light molecules. And you expose it, you pour in the A reagent, and suddenly all these molecules are supposed to grow by an A with a blocker at the end. And then you'll perform a reaction to take off the blocker, and then pour in a bunch of C molecules with blockers at the end, and that will then grow it all by C. And in any kind of a process like this, there's a certain chance that when you try to grow it by another base, there's going to be error involved. These are molecules. Molecules are small things. You can't do everything perfectly with them. With maybe 1% of the time, a base is not going to get properly inserted. Okay? And so if you start out with millions of molecules you're trying to make, if 1% of the time on every base extension a molecule goes bad, once you get try to grow too long a molecule, odds are all the copies that you have will have bad bases in them. Okay? It won't be faithfully replicating the string that you want. Okay? But for short enough molecules, the probability is very high that most of the molecules that you create will be exactly what you wanted. Okay? And that's why there's a technology-dependent limit. Any questions? Okay? So you can make small molecules to specification. In principle, you can chain these small molecules together to make big molecules. That's what they did in the synthesis of the polio virus. Okay? But again, it's error. You have to make sure you put all the pieces together right. It's complicated. Molecules are small. Any questions? Okay?
So another operation that biologists can do, and do a lot, is something called the polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. Okay?
And when we talk about PCR, what we really mean is molecule duplication. Okay? And PCR is an amazing... In some ways, a very, very simple idea, but this was a Nobel Prize-winning idea at the time. Okay?
Basically, you have a sample which has, you want to duplicate, and you know a little bit of sequence to the left of what you want to duplicate, and a little bit to the right of what you want to duplicate. You can use one of your synthesis machines to make a lot of the sequence to the left of it. A lot of the copies of the sequence to the right of it, these are both very short, so you can make them. And then naturally, by heating the molecules and cooling them, you're going to make copies of all the region in between. It's not that complicated. I don't really want to go into the details of it now. But the important thing is that given a single DNA molecule in a test tube, possibly with a lot of other junk in there, if you can specify the start regions and stop regions sequences of watching the area you're interested in, you can then say, make me millions of copies of the region in between. Okay? So it's used for amplification and copying. Okay? And several other things. Okay? But the basic idea is PCR enables us to take a small amount of DNA and make an arbitrarily large number of copies from it. Okay, and this is an important thing to be able to do. Any questions? Okay, yes.
Why would I want copies of the same molecule? Okay, well, a good example is going to be in when we talk about, I'll talk about it now. This idea, maybe you've heard about the idea of DNA fingerprinting.
You get into a fight with someone, you murder them, okay, and you leave the building, but you left a drop of blood behind, okay? And now, based on this drop of blood, once they catch you, they want to now prove that was in fact your blood that you left on the floor, okay? How can they do that, okay? Well, one thing they can do is take that little drop of blood that you left on the floor, and take a relevant piece portion of your DNA, your DNA, okay, and say, I want to make lots and lots of copies of the region between this pattern and that pattern, okay, and now I've got, from that little drop of blood, I've now got lots of it. Those of you who want to do Jurassic Park, you want to make dinosaurs, okay, you start out with a little bit of amber, okay, in principle, a tiny little bit of DNA there. You can make as many copies of those molecules as you wish using PCR. Okay, so PCR is a good thing. You make copies of small samples. Okay? Any questions? Yeah?
Does this mean that, for example, a human body has the same pattern of DNA?
So what is true is, everybody, being human, you all have some
of it. Your genome, your the DNA of your body, basically, your genome, as we call it, is going to be very, very similar to that of everybody else in the room. Different only in about 1 out of every 1,000 bases. 1 out of every 1,000 letters. So there's a great deal of similarity between all of your genomes. But there are regions where they differ. In particular, for DNA fingerprinting, to tell the difference, tell whose blood that is on the floor. There are certain regions of your genome which tend to occur in where there's repetition. In the sort of junk part of the DNA.
Okay?
The part that doesn't seem to do anything. Repetitions tend to accumulate.
Okay?
It says it's junk, it doesn't matter if you have 56 copies of ATATAT, or 300 copies, or 156 copies. And so this is something that just doesn't really matter. Everybody in the room likely has different numbers of copies of this junk region here. So what are the elementary operations that biologists can perform? We said they could copy DNA using PCR. They can also, using a technology called electrophoresis, measure the length of a DNA molecule.
Okay?
So electrophoresis is something, basically, it's given a molecule that can tell roughly how long it is.
Okay?
And, again, when you're measuring molecules, molecules are small things. You can't measure them perfectly accurately, especially if you allow a large size variation. But basically, electrophoresis lets you measure the length of a molecule. The way it works, I think, is kind of interesting. You have a molecule, it's sort of electrically charged like all molecules are, or like, you know, somehow everything seems to be.
Okay?
If you put it on a plate of jello,
okay,
and hook an electric field on one end, these molecules, because they're charged, are going to want to walk through the jello to get to the, towards the electric current. Now, if you're a molecule that's being pulled, how fast you can walk depends upon how big you are.
Okay?
A big, heavy molecule can't walk as fast as a little molecule. That sort of makes sense. If I have something pulling me with a little force, the lighter I am, the faster I can walk. So based on how far I walk, let it walk for 15 minutes in this electric field, based on how far I walk, I can tell how long I am.
Okay, you can tell how long I am.
Does that make sense? Okay, there's a correlation between length that you walk on the gel and the length of the molecule. And through that, this technique called electrophoresis, you can measure how long the fragments are.
Okay?
And this turns out to be a very useful operation, too.
Okay?
Any questions? Now, why might measuring the length of a molecule be useful? Well, remember that drop of blood we had on the floor from the murderer,
okay?
How can we tell that this is the murderer's blood sample? Well, one way that you could do it is you go to a region of the genome where it is known that there are lots of repetitions and that it varies from person to person,
okay?
That this is the number of repetitions, and let's say the pattern A, T, A, T, A, T, A, T. Maybe it's 300 in me, it's 156 in you, it's 392 in you.
Okay,
it doesn't make too much difference,
okay,
in terms of your ability to deliver anything. But it is a difference. So what can you do? You can take a region to the left of it and a region to the right of it, which is going to be the same in every person. It's the non-repetitive repeating stuff. Use those small pieces of DNA to amplify the region in between. Now we've got all the murderers, the number of duplications that the murderer has there. By measuring the length of these fragments, different people are going to have different lengths of fragments because they have different numbers of repetitions in here. If you have the same number of repetitions as the murderer, your sequence in here will be the same length as the murderer.
Okay.
But if not, that gives a way to distinguish.
Yes.
What is the precision? Well, so
such measurements are very accurate on, and again, any biologist, I haven't heard any complaints from any of the biologists here yet. I encourage, complaints if I'm lying or anything like this, okay, or misleading, or you have something else to say. But for over, the difference is, the precision is a function of what the range of fragments you're trying to measure is. So in other words, if you want to measure, is this molecule between 1 and 500 bases long, you can do that basically completely accurately, or very, very close. If you want to say, here I've got molecules that are between 30 and 50,000 bases long, maybe there'll be a 5% error, something in that range. Okay? So it depends upon the accuracy you want. For small fragments, you can get very good absolute accuracy. For longer fragments, is a relative accuracy that you're getting. Yeah? Well, it's going to work in this example because the region is very short. Okay, let's say this is about 1,000 bases long. And maybe the repetitions will differ by, depending on the number of repetitions you have, maybe each repeating unit is 3 bases long. So the longer you can measure within 3 bases, okay, that will tell you how many repetitions you have. Okay? Or, at least it'd be accurate enough to grossly distinguish whether you might be the murderer or not. Maybe, you've got, I'll come with this and say, well, Alex has 53 plus or minus 2 repetitions, and the murderer had 73 plus or minus 2 repetitions. We know Alex is not the murderer, okay? But it may be someone else in this room, okay? Any questions? Yeah. Well, there's lots of the repetitions turn out to happen all over the place in this, this sort of non-coding junk DNA is a complicated business. There's lots of repetitions of different types. Okay, so this is one way you can do fingerprinting. Another more accurate way to do fingerprinting is actually to just do sequencing. Take a highly variable region. And I can sequence this region. Let's say the murderer was very important, like O.J. Simpson, and you're willing to devote a lot of resources to try to make sure he's accurate. Instead of just measuring the length, you might be able to sequence the entire fragment. These days, that's probably even, that's slightly more complicated, but not a very complicated thing to do. And that gives you even more confidence that you've got the right one. Okay? Any questions? So the point is, you think of biologists capable of certain elementary operations. They can synthesize short pieces of DNA. They can amplify pieces of DNA based on flanking regions. Okay? They can measure the length of molecules to some degree of accuracy. Okay? And they can use a DNA sequencing machine to give a small molecule of DNA, like 500 bases, read the sequence of bases of that molecule. So you can synthesize very short pieces, 25, 50. From a sequencing machine, you can read the sequence of a molecule of about 500 bases. Okay, and these are sort of things you can do in the lab that we'll assume every lab is capable of. Any questions? Okay, so that's the basic biotechnologies that we will work with from now on. Okay, any questions? Okay. What I would like to now do is switch gears a little bit. And we've talked about what I would say is fairly elementary biology. All the biologists may have been snickering. Okay? Now it is perhaps a chance for the computer scientists to snicker. Okay? I would like to talk a little bit about some of the principles of computer science, or specifically algorithm design, that we're going to be using. Okay, so don't be afraid to ask questions if you don't understand something or clarify it. Okay, you've heard the quality of questions that people have been asking in the life science, the silly life science questions. You may ask equally silly questions without fear of problems. Okay, so what are we going to talk about in computer science? Well, in computer science, primarily what I'm interested in, or what we are interested in, is the design of correct and efficient algorithms for solving a problem. So what is an algorithm? Okay, a program, as you know, is something that takes as input takes some input and produces some output. An algorithm is somehow the idea or the procedure that the program implements to go through and make the decision of what to output. Okay? So when I use the word algorithm, I'm not talking about a program. I am talking about a logical sequence of steps that will solve the problem. And that this algorithm might be later programmed in C language or Perl or any other programming language. The algorithm is something that's somehow independent of the program. Okay, it's the idea behind the program. Okay? And we're going to be interested in, again, algorithms that correctly solve problems. And we're going to be interested in algorithms that efficiently solve problems. And when we talk about problems, we're going to be interested in what we will call well-defined combinatorial problems. And this is probably something that's a little bit of a cultural difference between the computer scientist and the biologist. The biologist may have a problem that they want to solve. I want you to analyze this DNA sequence and find the genes. Okay? That may be your idea of a problem. It is not my idea of a problem. Okay? Why? You don't know what is a gene. You haven't told me what a gene is. Okay? You have to tell me somehow what a gene is, define what a gene is in order for me to come up with an algorithm to find them. I need a clear characteristic to know what is a success and what isn't a success. Okay? I need something that is well-defined and completely defined for me to distinguish it as a particular problem of interest. Okay? So my quest, when you guys give me a problem that's sort of ill-defined, and finding a gene, finding the genes is ill-defined, finding promoters is ill-defined, is to find some way to pin you down about exactly what you mean by a gene, okay? And once we come up with a well-defined definition, then we can sit down and write a program. That's the way that we live, okay? We only deal with well-defined problems, okay? Any questions? So, a distinction that we think about quite often is the distinction between a heuristic and an algorithm. An algorithm to a computer scientist is a procedure that absolutely definitely gives you the right answer to your well-defined problem. A heuristic is something that sort of gives me something that's probably pretty close to the right answer of a well-defined problem. So heuristics are sort of rules of thumb, things that are good, but are not necessarily provably correct. Don't necessarily give me the best possible answer. Okay? And so heuristics, you know, are often necessary and useful. But of course, I'm always looking for an algorithm I can prove something about, something I can say, this one really does the right thing. Okay? Such algorithms don't necessarily always exist, okay, for certain problems, as we will see. But I'm always going to be interested in coming up with a problem that I can give a yes or no answer, this is going to come up with the right answer. Okay? Any questions about that? Okay? It's a different mindset. Okay, I'm not looking for an answer good enough. I'm looking for an answer. Okay? And so what we will typically do, our procedure as algorithms person, is that I will try to extract the clean, well-defined problem from the messy problem that you give me. You have a real-life problem that you're interested in, find genes. I am not going to really be able to solve that. What I'm going to be able to do is talk with you to identify a well-defined problem that hopefully I can solve. And then I can talk about solving it exactly. Okay? And so the way I would think about my process versus what you might think I should be doing is the difference between in vitro and in vivo experimentation. In vitro means in a test tube. Okay? In vitro means in life. Okay? When biologists do experiments, in principle, you want to figure out how the living thing works. You do the experiment in a living cell or in a living organism. But some things are too complicated to find out, to prove in an organism right away. You start by saying, gee, does this drug turn off, turn off sugar production in a, sugar consumption in a particular system? It might be easier to study that at first in an abstract system, in an extract from the cell rather than the living organism itself. And likewise, we're going to want to study the clean problems rather than the messy ones. At least to get a handle on the messy ones. Any questions? Okay? That's philosophy. Well, let me show you an example of a clean problem. That is a problem that is actually going to be fairly important in sequence analysis. Is that a string comparison? Okay? So the string matching problem, okay, is the following kind of problem. We need to have a well-defined input and a well-defined output. Exact string matching takes as input a string key, a text string, okay, which we'll say is of length n characters, and it takes as input a pattern character string, t, which is of m characters, and tells us what is the position, what are all the positions, okay, or the first position, where in the text where the pattern exists, i.e., where starting from position I, the next m characters are exactly those occurring in the pattern. Okay, that's what we mean by string matching. Okay? Any questions? Okay, and why might string matching be an interesting or important problem? Does anyone think of an application for programs that do this string matching? Okay? Yeah? DNA comparison is a good example of an application where exact string comparison is not that important. Why? Because exact string comparison is probably not going to be very important to biologists in a lot of ways. Because more of them are going to be interested in things that are approximately similar. Okay? Actually, maybe I jumped into that a little too quickly. Where's one where a case where exact string matching applies? Let's say outside of biology. Parsing and compilers, that's a computer science-y thing. Anything else? Text editor, okay, or when you're in Microsoft Word or in Google, you want to say, Jesus, the word schema occur anywhere in your document, okay? You want to type in an exact pattern and know whether that string exactly occurs, okay? So it's clearly a useful problem, and the following algorithm will solve this exact matching problem. Okay, I'll call it a brute force algorithm. I'm going to have a loop that's going to try every possible starting position in the original text. If the string is of length n and the pattern is of length m, there's actually n minus m possible starting positions before the pattern would fall off the end of the string. Okay, for every possible starting position, I'm going to set another counter j, and then count while j is less than the length of the pattern, if the I plus j character in the text is the same as the j character in the pattern, that's good, I've matched another position. Okay? If so, bump the j pointer up by one. If not, that means that this point in the text is no longer valid. Okay, that there's no hope of matching that pattern from this position in the text. Let me bump the starting position of my text up by one and keep looking. Any questions about that algorithm? Okay? Of the biology people, how many people sort of understand that algorithm? Okay, are the biology people, anybody confused, any questions from the biology people? Yes. Why do I have two equal signs? Okay, so this algorithm as I'm writing, the question is, what language am I writing this algorithm in? Okay, and this is when you write algorithms, remember, algorithms are independent of programming language. So this algorithm could be programmed in Perl or C or something, but I have to write it down in something. So I write it down in some sort of artificial programming language that looks like other programming languages. Now, in my particular language, which is true of a lot of languages, when you want to compare, or is something equal to something else, you will have the double equals. Whereas actually assigning this to be equal to that is single equals. Okay, so single equals means assignment. Double equals means comparison. Okay? And the reason it's like this is in languages it didn't do that. A lot of people assign things when they thought they were comparing things and it was an ugly situation. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Can everybody sort of see the idea behind this algorithm? Okay? Now, how much time does this algorithm take? What's the smallest number of comparisons? Let's say, when we talk about an algorithm, we want to analyze how efficient it is. When I analyze it, there's three kinds of things you might be interested in. Under what condition does the algorithm run the fastest? Under what condition does the algorithm run the slowest? And under what does it normally do? Okay? For a string matching algorithm like this, suppose I give you a string, your text string is of length n, your pattern is of length m. What would be an example of a pattern in text that this algorithm would work very, very fast on? Someone with a hand, okay? Yes. So one way that this could work very fast is on a success where the first m characters of the text string was the same as the pattern, right? Then how much time would it take? N comparisons, because it would start from the beginning, go left to right, and first m test, it's done, it's in the first spot. What is the fastest it could succeed on an unsuccessful comparison? You look for Skeena in the Bible, okay? You're not going to find it, okay? Can you design a string and a pattern such the pattern is not in the string, and yet it does works pretty efficiently? Okay, well one would be, okay, so what cases are, one possibly would say the pattern is much longer than the string. Okay, I want to find a 100 character pattern and a 50 character string. Yes, I agree with you that that's a failure, but it's a relatively uninteresting failure. Okay, another one would be to say, well, what if my pattern was one character long? That's true, but we would like to get our complexity, our measure of how efficient it is, should be a function of both the length of the text and the length of the pattern. So, you know, sort of saying that, oh, look, your algorithm's very fast when you have a pattern of length 0 is not interesting, or 1, okay? First, can we design inputs such that this program will fail quickly, even if N and M are very large, okay? Any ideas? You think if they don't match at any point? So what about the following example? I think that's exactly what I'm trying to capture. Suppose my text was a long string of A's. A, N A's. And my pattern was M B's. What will happen when I execute this pattern, this thing? Then I'm going to start at the left and I'm going to say, is the first character of the text a B? No. Then is the first character, the second character of the text a B? No. No, 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 no. I'm going to spend N steps, the length of my string, in the worst case. I mean, in the best case. I might fail as quickly as N steps. Does everybody see that? Especially the biologists. If not, I'd like to hear some questions. Okay, yes?
Is it possible to perform the R2 N minus 10 plus 1?
Yeah.
So, this would be actually for, how the pattern
is named.
It's not a match.
Should
be
not anything
for N minus 10 plus 1?
Okay, so you're saying, what you're saying is that you're right in saying that since this outer loop, suppose n was t was 1,000, and the pattern here was 500 long. You're right, I could give up after 500 steps in this case. So in fact, the number of steps I use would probably be N minus M. Okay? That would probably be a more accurate statement. Okay? Any questions? Okay? The question of how accurate we need to be in doing this analysis is going to be where we get into the big O notation in a few minutes. Okay? But I agree with you that you're being more precise than I am. Any questions? Okay. What is the worst case for this? The fastest, we know this algorithm, if we get very lucky, we might succeed after M steps, or we might fail after N steps. What if we get very unlucky? How much time might this take? Okay? What would be an example of a text string and a pattern where it takes a long time before this algorithm finishes? Okay? Any ideas? Yep? Okay, so the question is, what if the first N minus 1 characters of the pattern match, but not the last one? So let's take a look at this string. Suppose my text string was all A's, and my pattern string was all A's with one last B. What is this algorithm going to do? It's going to start out at the beginning, say A equals A, blah, 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 blah. Oops, at the end steps, I see a mismatch. So it can't match in the first position. I'll then start from the second position and say A equals A. Oops, it failed from the last time. How many steps is that going to take as a function of N and M? Okay, to be precise, N minus M times M. Okay? Me being a little sloppy, I'll say N times M. Typically, N is going to be much bigger than M. Okay? So I'll say, but you're right. N minus M times M steps. And we fail. Okay? Now, what will happen in practice? Do all the biologists see why that is basically N times M steps? Okay? And why, if we get very, very unlucky in the input, we're in trouble. Okay? Or not in trouble, it'll be much more expensive than it might otherwise seem. Any questions? Now, what will happen in practice? How many steps will it take in practice? Anyone want to guess? Okay, I don't want to guess. I don't have any idea, to be perfectly honest with you. Okay? It depends upon what you're assuming your input text and output text are. Okay? If you have some, once you make an assumption about what properties they have, maybe that question has an answer. But I don't know what in practice means. Okay? So in general, I can't tell you what will happen in practice, but I can tell you what will happen in the worst case. And that's typically the kind of analysis that I'm going to want to do. Okay? Because in practice, it's hard. Okay? In fact, it's ill-defined. Okay? Until you define what in practice means, I have no chance of analyzing it. Any questions? Okay? Now, what I can tell you, though, is that a smart algorithm person can design an algorithm to solve the string matching problem. So in the worst case, it takes time that is linear in the size of the pattern and the size of the text. So by working on the worst case and beating down the worst case, I can in fact turn the worst case into not much, basically the best case of this algorithm. Okay? So there's a much better exact string matching, which hopefully Google and your text editor employ, such that the time it takes is going to be linear in basically N plus M instead of N times M. Okay, that's the best you can hope to do. You've got to actually read the pattern. You've got to actually read the text. Okay? And so by working on the worst case and being clever, we can hope to do better. Okay? And that's how the algorithms person works. Okay? This is the happy ending. Okay? The worst case performance is always good. Any questions? Okay? So the important thing is, this is kind of how we're going to be working. We're going to analyze algorithms by counting the worst case number of steps. Okay? And for well-defined clean problems. Now, an important thing to see here is that certain generalizations of our well-defined clean problem will have the same analysis as what I just told you. So, for example, if I ask you to stop on the first time you see a pattern, its worst-case time is still going to be order n squared, n times m. If I have to find all occurrences of the pattern, by that same analysis, it can still be done in n times m. Okay? So the generalization to find all, or the first or the last, are basically the same problem. Certain other generalizations will change the problem and make it more complicated. Like, for example, suppose I want to know whether the pattern exists, but I can split it into pieces. Let's say I'm looking for Skeena, and I want to know whether there exists the letters S-K-I-E-N-A somewhere in the text in order, but you're allowed to have gaps. That's a seemingly a much different problem. Okay, biologically that's important. It turns out when you're comparing biological sequence, letting you know that gaps are allowed turns out to be important. Okay? So that will make the problem more difficult. Some things make it harder, some things don't. But we want to analyze clean problems so we really know what's going on. Any questions? Okay, that is our modus operandi. Yes? So the problem with gaps will correspond to something like approximate string matching or and dynamic programming. And we'll be talking about the case of approximate string matching. String matching where you allow a small amount of mismatches, or where you allow gaps and things like that. That's what we'll talk about later on in the semester when we talk about sequence comparison. Because biologically, you're going to want to compare sequences, not exactly, but usually because there's going to be mutations and evolutionary distance and things like that. You want to compare it so that you want to find, where does this pattern almost match the text? And that problem we'll talk about later in the semester. Any questions? Okay, good. So, this semester, when I talk about the efficiency of an algorithm, I am basically going to be counting the worst case number of steps. That's what I mean by the complexity. What I'm also going to do is ignore certain details. Okay? Like with the question of what was the time, how many steps did it take for the worst case of string matching? I said it was n, the length of the pattern, times m, the length of the text. Someone here correctly said, no, it's n minus m, times n. Okay? That kind of difference is not going to be interesting to me. And there's a mathematical distinction, something called the big O notation, for on the order of, which is sort of a technically precise way to ignore these relatively small differences. So when I have n, say something is order of n times n, that could mean m over 2 times n, it could be m over 10 times n, it could be 156 m times n, it could be 156 plus times n plus n plus n squared, okay? So the big O notation, when you see me write big O of notation, I mean on the order of this many steps, approximately that many steps, okay? And I'm going to ignore details like is it 2 times this or 10 times this or 100 times this. That turns out to be uninteresting as far as I'm concerned. In practice, does it make a difference if it's 1,000 times slower? Yes. But we're going to ignore that when we think about our algorithms. It just clutters the mind. Okay? Any questions? So, will the biologist not be afraid when we see a big O of something? Interpret that as being approximately this times this many steps, and everything will be fine. Any questions? Good. Now, when we talk of the reason why we're going to talk about these algorithms in this rough, approximate manner, this order of manner, why are we being so sloppy? Okay, how can we get away with it? The reason is because we want to know, basically, is it going to be fast enough, the algorithm going to be fast enough for an application of reasonable size? So we say a linear algorithm is one that grows like order n plus m. A linear time algorithm is going to be basically fast enough for almost any size application. The human genome is 3 billion bases long. I ask you to write a program to scan through the human genome and count how many A's, C's, G's, and D's there are. That could be done in linear time, and that could be done in a small number of minutes or seconds on any reasonable computer. Okay? Even for N equals a billion or something like that. A quadratic algorithm, something that grows like N times N, or N times M, the number of steps that algorithm uses is going to grow very, very fast as a function of N. So if you think about it, let's say that a million, you guys have souped-up Pentiums. It runs at a gigahertz or something like that, right? These are terms you guys know. A gigahertz, I think of as being about, what is that, a billion instructions per second. Okay? A billion is a large number. Okay? Let's say you wanted to do a billion steps per second. How big a problem is it going to be before a n squared algorithm is going to take a billion steps? What n is n times n equal to a billion? Okay? I think it's like 10,000, is that right?
Okay? That's right, 10,000, I can't do this very quickly. 10,000 adds 4 more zeros. That's 100 million. So it's 10,000, more like 30,000. If I have an algorithm that is going to take n squared steps, and n is about 30,000, at that point I'm doing a billion things. And a billion steps takes time. You know, when I say that your Pentium can do a billion steps per second, they're lying to a large extent, because those steps that they're talking about are very, very, very tiny steps. An interesting step might take 100 instructions or something like that, which is why we're ignoring that. That's why I'm talking about big O. I'm ignoring this deal. But a billion starts to be a serious number of steps. Okay? And this tells me that an n squared algorithm, something like the famous Smith-Waterman algorithm for approximate string matching, okay? You could only hope to do that for something like n equals 10,000, 30,000, before it starts taking hopelessly long. Okay? And this is why we're worried about, is an algorithm quadratic or linear? Okay? Because the difference between n squared and n becomes very dramatic once you start talking about serious problem sizes. Okay? Any questions about this? Okay? This is sort of the key point behind why we're analyzing algorithms the way we are. Okay? Because this is where the difference is. Okay? It doesn't matter if you're running it on a computer that's twice as fast. Big deal. It's only a factor of two. You may say, I'm writing up my program in Perl, so what if I wrote it in C? C is 100 times faster. 100 times faster, no big deal. Okay? But the difference between n squared and n is a big deal. Okay? By the time you get to n equals 30,000. And a lot of problems can be solved only by exponential time algorithms, where the number of steps to solve a problem of size n might grow as something like 2 to the n. Or n factorial. Well, 2 to the n is 2 to the 20 is going to be a million. 2 to the what is going to be a billion? 23, 24, no, 2 to the 30, something like that. Okay?
So if I give you, tell me, oh, I want to solve this problem in analyzing evolutionary trees. In fact, many of those algorithms are known to be exponential. If it takes times 2 to the n, by the time you get up to n equals 30, you're in trouble. Okay? You can't hope to analyze 100 species that way, or 50 species that way. Okay? So knowing this gross order of growth is the key to understanding what is efficient enough. Okay? Any questions? This is why we think like this. Okay? Even though it seems kind of weird to the outsider. Okay? But this is, I think, the way we count. Any questions? Okay? Again, we're a little bit sloppy. You know, this quote I always liked, but from a senator who was worried about the budget. Okay? He said, sort of a billion here, a billion there, and soon you're talking about real money. Okay? Likewise, a billion steps here, a billion steps there. Once you start talking about n squared, you're talking serious money. Yes? Yeah. Okay, so the question that is a valid point, I may be saying that coming up with an algorithm and ignoring this factor of 100 times it. And I say, oh, I'll write it in, if I write it in Perl, it'll be 100 times slower than C. 100 times does make a difference if your program is going to run for, you know, if it's a difference between a day or 6 months, I agree with you, that's a difference. On the other hand, if your program is running 6 months, it is probably the case that a smarter algorithm would be more important than rewriting it in C. Okay? That would be sort of my way of looking at it. When I have, when problems come in the door, if you tell me, oh, look, I write it in Perl, it takes 6 seconds, 10 seconds to run, big deal, you've got the 10 seconds, you can wait. Okay? And you wouldn't bother to rewrite it in C so it runs in 1/100th of a second. Okay? But on the other hand, if you're coming to me and telling me, oh, I've got this problem and my program is taking 6 months, I would not say rewrite it in C. I would say, what are you doing? What is your algorithm that is taking so long? And quite likely you'll be doing something that is n squared, 2 to the n, something like this, that maybe a more clever algorithm would reduce it to the point where you could write it in Perl, you could write it in molasses, and it would run as fast. Okay? Any questions? And sometimes you can't. Sometimes the reason it will take 6 months is because your problem is I.O. bound. Your process, you have to suck so much data off the disk that you need to keep the disk spinning for 6 months. So an algorithm efficiency is not everything, but it's a good part of the game. Any questions? Okay, good. Okay. Now, I'd like to expose you to one of the more intellectually interesting ideas in computer science, in my mind, okay, that will come up sometimes occasionally will come up in the course of our course, is an idea of NP-completeness. A computer scientist will say that a problem is NP-complete if there is no known polynomial time algorithm for it. Okay, so you're going to come back to something stronger, okay? Polynomial time algorithm means it ran an n squared time, n cubed time, n time. If a problem is np complete, there is no algorithm that runs faster than 2 to the n. Okay? Meaning that you're stuck. You won't be able to solve this problem exactly for large instances. Okay? And saying something is np complete, it's not only just that there is no algorithm that is known to solve the problem. More amazingly, you can show essentially that no such algorithm can possibly exist. It's not exactly what, the exact technical distinction isn't, I don't really want to get into. But essentially, if a problem, you can prove that a problem is NP complete, you can, it's more than saying that not only is there no algorithm for this known, okay, that's efficient, no algorithm can be known without the world changing in a dramatic way. Okay? So once I prove my problem is NP complete, only a fool would keep looking for an efficient algorithm for it. Okay? You would have to look for some other tactic to try to solve it. Okay? Any questions? And it turns out that a lot of problems that people want to solve and that biologists want to solve turn out to be incomplete problems. Okay? A lot of the problems in analyzing evolutionary data turn out to be incomplete. Okay? Yes. So technically, okay, incomplete problem, proving a problem incomplete, it is slightly weaker than saying that no such algorithm can exist, but it is true to say that no algorithm would exist without changing our conception of the world. Okay? So if you find that a proof of problem is incomplete, to my business, that's as good as saying you won't find an efficient algorithm for it. Okay? There's some technical ifs and buts, but I don't consider them very important. Okay? And certainly to the people in this room, it shouldn't be important. Once you prove that something's incomplete, you give up on trying to solve it exactly. Okay? Unless you're looking at extremely small problems. Any questions? So a lot of evolutionary problems, analyzing evolutionary problems, building the best phylogenetic tree, you can show that's incomplete. A lot of problems in optimizing a technology. Okay, how do you use this technology in the most efficient way? That turns out to be incomplete. The problem of sequence assembly, which we're going to be talking about over the next couple of classes, is incomplete. And in fact, that I'll even let prove for you right now. Okay? So, proving that a problem is incomplete is an important thing, because it shows no such algorithm, an efficient algorithm in the worst case is going to exist. And it happens that a lot of biological problems have this property. Now, one thing I remember being very amused by, at one computational biology conference a few years ago, there were so many papers by computer scientists proving that the biological problems were incomplete, the biologists started booing. Okay? They didn't want to know, first of all, they didn't want to know that their problem was incomplete, because incomplete says you can't do it. They want to do it, okay? And the fact that it's incomplete doesn't change the fact that they want to do it, okay? So proving a problem is incomplete is in some sense a negative thing, that you can't do it that way. But it's also, I think, an important and a positive thing, because it shows that you sort of understand what you're dealing with, and you can now find alternate strategies, heuristics, okay, things like that, to deal with the problem once you understand it. Okay, any questions? Yeah.
Perhaps we should
stop the movie to make arbitrary long but in biology, we'll have arbitrary long. Okay, so say what exactly an incompleteness proof means. Again, I'm not saying it's more for the biologist. Okay, there's some technical if, ands, and buts how applicable it means when you prove something is hard. Is it really hopeless to try to solve it in practice? Okay? For our purposes, it's going to be our technical claim that once a problem is incomplete, you give up looking for a polynomial worst-case algorithm for it. That doesn't mean that you need to give up on ever trying to do computations like that. Because maybe even look for heuristics that almost solve it. Maybe your problem is small enough that brute force will do it. Okay? There are other things that you might be able to do. But when it's incomplete, you give up on looking for a worst-case algorithm that's efficient. Okay? Any questions? Okay? That's sort of the importance to us. Okay? So what is an incomplete? How do we prove a problem is incomplete? I'm going to go through this just as sort of an example. At some point, we may lose some of the biologists, if so, it's okay. It's important to know what we mean by incomplete. Incomplete means give it up, it's too hard, you can solve exactly. Okay? I'm not going to show you how you would show such a thing. Okay? And what might be an example of an incomplete problem? Okay? So let's look here. Here is a famous incomplete problem. Something called shortest common superstring. Okay? If it's a problem, if we as computer scientists want to deal with it, it needs to be well, nicely defined. So I've got an input and an output here. The input is a set of text strings, okay, And the output is the sort of string such that every one of my input strings appears somewhere as a substring, meaning a consecutive sequence of characters, somewhere within my shortest such string. Okay? So for example, suppose I give you the sequence, the set of strings A, B, B, A, ABBA, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, A, and B, B, A, A. So the rock group, what the sheep says, and I guess what my child says and what the sheep says. Okay? ABBA, BABBA, and BUBBA. Okay? What is an example of a superstring that contains all of them? Can someone give me a string that contains all of those substrings? One way to do it, a nice way to do it, might be just to concatenate them. ABBA, BABBA, BUBBA. Okay? That is a string that contains all of them, right? Is that the shortest substring, possible string? Someone want to propose a shorter one? Yeah? Oh, but it's big, yes. B, A, which one do you want first? The BABBA? BABBA? So you want to have ABBA, okay, well you can't, so you can have, so you can say that A, and now you're going to have ABBA, and then have BBAA. So you save one character, I believe. What? So what you want to say is, okay, I can't, let's say I can't, how many characters is your string? Eight. My original one was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. So you've shortened it by 4. Does anybody want to propose a shorter one or an alternate one? Does one exist? Okay. The shortest common superstring problem takes as input a set of strings, okay, and asks for the shortest string that contains them all. Okay? And it's a well-defined problem. I think everyone will agree with that. Okay? If I give you a set of strings, it has an answer. Okay? It may have multiple answers. There may be many strings, shortest common superstrings. But certainly there's the length. The shortest possible length is unique for any set of strings. This problem, as we will see in a couple of classes, arises in DNA sequence assembly. Can anybody propose an algorithm to solve this, to, given a set of strings, to find the shortest possible superstring? Does anyone want to propose an algorithm for that? Yeah?
Population of all possible strings.
Okay, so what possibly you might say is you might try to build all possible, let's say this alphabet has four letters in it. You may want to build all 4 to the 1 million strings of length 1 million or less, or something like that. And try each one. Is this a superstring of everything? And is this shorter than every one I've seen so far? So you could do this by exhaustive search, by building all possible strings and then seeing if it has this as a substring, and if so, report the smallest one. But that is going to be extremely time-consuming and hopelessly exponential. That is something like 4 to the n, 4 to the something, hopelessly exponential. Does anyone want to propose another algorithm? What? Start with the longest string in my set and do what with it? So you're proposing some kind of an algorithm where you start with one of these strings and you concatenate, you see if there's anything that will overlap it, any of the other strings that will overlap it, and grow it in some way. So one possibility is a variety. He's proposing looking at all possible arrangements of the strings. Well, if you've got n strings, how many permutations are there? N factorial, so that's trouble, that's exponential. Okay? That can't be done for any reasonable size to n.
We can subtract all the strings and try to remove
one at a time. So Amelia and I will concatenate the strings, remove one at a time. Probably, if you think about this for a while, the most obvious strategy is something we might call the greedy heuristic, which says that I take as input all my strings and find which two overlap by the most. Okay, find the two that overlap by the most, okay, and concatenate them. Then delete the two strings that overlap by the most from my set and replace it with the concatenated version. And keep doing that. I've now reduced my number of strings by one. If I keep doing this n times, I'll eventually come out with one string that clearly is a superstring of the set. Do people sort of see what my algorithm is, or are there any questions about the algorithm? So the natural idea might be the greedy heuristic. So for example, suppose I give you these strings. Okay? AA, BABA, a bunch of BAB, three ABs or something like that. I've got BA, BA, BA ending in B, and ABAB ending in C. Okay? What would the greedy algorithm do? If you look at this particular example here, these two strings overlap in all but one character on each side. Does everybody see that? If I have, here's one where I have, they're all ABs, except one has two A's to start and one has a C at the end. These two overlap by, what you call it, by as much as possible without them being the identical strings. So suppose I merge them. Now, unfortunately, this has now, the combined string now has two A's on one side and a C on the other side. The other string is all BA's, BA's. There is no way you can sort of merge that in here without, you know, basically it doesn't overlap anywhere. So if we use the greedy heuristic, we're going to get as our string, it's going to start out AA, then you're going to have a bunch of ABs, then a C, and then a bunch of ABs. Okay? In fact, that's not the optimal way to do it. Here is the optimal way to do it. Okay? And you'll see it's actually almost half as long as the other way, the way that the greedy algorithm would come up with. Okay? So what's the point of this example? There are a couple of things that should be maybe revelations to the biologists here, but it's important to see here. Here we have a common sense logical rule, this greedy heuristic, that minus the two that overlaps the most possible and does that. It will yield the wrong answer on certain input. Some input it will yield the right answer. But in the worst case, it will yield the wrong answer. Okay? And in fact, it might yield something that's very much the wrong answer. It might yield a string that's twice as long as it has to be. Okay? So although the greedy heuristic is a good idea, a good rule of thumb, a good heuristic, and may do very well in practice, in the worst case, it might do very, very bad. Okay? That's because it's a heuristic for the problem and not an algorithm. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So this is why we look for algorithms that are provably right. Okay? And this fails the test. Okay? How much time does it take to actually implement this heuristic, though? What would be, since we're talking about counting steps, let's use this as an excuse to get some more practice counting steps. How many steps does the greedy heuristic take? Okay? So, Let me count it the way I want to count it.
Okay.
I want to compare all pairs of strings against all pairs of strings, right? I want to find out, first of all, given n strings, which two overlap by the most? That's what I'm going to be doing my merging for. So I'm going to have to do, if I have n strings, there's n squared pairs. If each string is of length L, how much time will it take to find the longest overlap of two strings of length L? Can anybody propose an algorithm to tell me how much two strings of length L overlap? Sort of like exact string matching algorithm, except that it's a little bit different because I really want to know it's a prefix-suffix matching. But I can try this one. Do they overlap completely? That might take L steps. I can shift the other one character over. That might take L minus 1 steps, L minus 2, dot, dot, dot. Basically, L times L. So my overlap testing can be done in L squared time. And then, so in N squared times L squared time, I would do one of these overlaps, merge them, and replace them. I need to do this a total of n times because I have to get rid of one string each iteration. That would be n times n squared times L squared, or n cubed times L squared times. Okay? And I would find the shortest string under this heuristic. Okay? Any questions about that? Does everybody sort of see where the n cubed times L squared comes from? Any questions about that, especially from our biologist friends? Our life science friends, to be precise, or natural science friends. Okay? So, in fact, by being cleverer, you can implement the greedy algorithm much faster than that. Okay? But, because that's still kind of bad if n is large. Okay? But the worst thing is it doesn't even give us the right answer. It's not even a question of efficiency. It doesn't give us the right answer. Any questions? Well, I am not surprised that the greedy heuristic does not give us the right answer because no algorithm is going to give us the right answer to this. No efficient algorithm. Why? Because the shortest common superstring problem is NP complete. NP complete, remember, to us means there is no efficient worst-case algorithm for it. Okay? Let me try to prove that in the next 5 minutes. It's probably a hopeless task, okay? But let me try at least. The way I prove something NP complete, okay, is by taking a problem that I know is NP complete, a famous problem that I know is NP complete, and show that if I could solve this new problem, like shortest common superstring, then I could solve some other problem that is famous, that I know is hard. Okay? So what is the thought process? There's a problem called Hamiltonian path or Hamiltonian cycle, which, given a network of points and lines, asks if there is a way to visit every point exactly once and get back to where I started from. Okay? So, the following is actually some terminology that biologists should know. When computer scientists talk about graphs, okay, biologists, I think of graphs as squiggly lines that go up or down. Okay? Like stockbrokers think of graphs that way. A computer scientist thinks of a graph as a network of points and lines. So fairly often in the course of the semester, I will talk about graphs. A graph is like a road network, okay, where there are junction vertices, namely where you can make a turn, where certain pairs of vertices are connected by a road between them. Okay, so this is a graph. The Hamiltonian cycle problem asks, is there a way to visit every junction and get back to where you started from without visiting every junction more than once. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Does the following graph have a Hamiltonian path?
Take a look.
This graph here, it has seven vertices. Is there a Hamiltonian cycle here? Can you start driving at one point and get back to where you're going while visiting every vertex exactly once? No, because you start out here. Once you take this bridge, there's no way to get back and finish the job without crossing that bridge again, right? So this graph does not have a Hamiltonian cycle. On the other hand, this graph up here does. Okay, if you look over here, I have all the vertices. I'm visiting them exactly once and getting back to where I started from. Okay? So some graphs have such a property that you can do it. Some graphs you can't do it. And the Hamiltonian cycle problem is, given as input a graph, tell me whether you can do it. Okay? And this problem is known to be NP-complete. Okay, it's known that you cannot find an efficient algorithm for that problem. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Any questions about Hamiltonian paths or anything like that? Okay? Does anybody see any connection between such paths and shortest common strings, superstrings? Okay? Remember the shortest common superstring problem? I give you as input a bunch of strings, and I ask you, is there a way to assemble them in a sequence so that all the strings appear, okay, and it's as short as possible? Yeah?
Yes, the strings can be
very close before we graph, and two rows of the top and then we can be. Okay? So the problem should smell a little bit the same in some ways. Why? What do you want to do in shortest common superstring? You want a sequence where you visit every string exactly once, right? Why do you want to visit every string? Because it needs to be a superstring, right? It's got to contain all of them. Why do you want to visit every one of them exactly once? Because you want to make it short. If you're taking a detour to visit it a bunch of times, it's probably not going to be short. Okay? So if you think about it a little bit, there is some... The two problems are not as grossly different as you might think. Okay? At some core, they're about the same. Okay? You're really good at this kind of stuff. This is not something that everybody can sort of look at those problems and see that. But once it's explained to you, I think you can sort of get the idea that there is a connection between them. Okay? The NP-completeness proof is basically showing you that connection, okay, as was explained. We take as input a graph, and we're going to design a set of strings with the property that the shortest common superstring is going to somehow, and the new string is going to somehow reveal the Hamiltonian cycle in the original graph, okay? That's the completeness proof. We don't really have enough time to go through it now. Okay, we may go through it next class, okay, or if we have time or not. Any questions? Okay, but the basic idea that I want our biologists to understand from this lecture is, first of all, we count steps to measure time efficiency. Second, algorithms can be wrong, that they don't necessarily give you a heuristic that makes a lot of sense, might not give you the absolute right answer. And for certain problems, there is no way of doing it that will guarantee you the right answer in a reasonable amount of time. Any questions? Okay, that said, next class we're going to have a little bit of an introduction to some of the bioinformatics kind of software, databases, and a programming language called Perl that's relevant to this stuff. Any questions? Okay, see you on Tuesday. Thank you.